Have you heard of Parma ham? It's made and cured in the hills around Parma, Italy, and it's one of the many foods that can only be labeled that way if it is made in a certain place. Since the mid-1990s, the European Union has been restricting what people call the products they make. Now the EU wants to impose more of those restrictions on U.S. producers. From member station WUWM in Milwaukee, LaToya Dennis reports.
So we all know the age-old question Juliet asked Romeo in one of Shakespeare's famed plays, What's in a Name? Kyle Cherick says depending on what product you're talking about, it could be a lot. He's producer and host of a television show called Wisconsin Foodie.
So lambic beers have to come, absolutely have to come from that valley. Roquefort, of course, has to come from that region because we've got a fungus that gives it that flavor. Champagne, of course, we all know. We like to say Maine lobster. I mean, there's really just an American lobster, right? American Vidalia onions should only come, in my opinion, with that name from Vidalia, Georgia.
Cherick argues that sometimes certain food products are so unique that only one country or region should be allowed to lay claim. But he says not everything fits into that category. Take, for instance, cheddar cheese.
They simply can't legislate that into a region. Cheddar's made in Australia and in the U.S. and Canada. It's made in probably 7 or 8 countries.
And therein lies the problem. As part of negotiations over the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the EU wants the U.S. to prohibit food makers here from using names with historical ties to Europe.
Here we make Havarti, Gouda, we make our own Stettler Swiss, we make a Kobe Swiss.
That's Steve Stettler, who owns Decatur Dairy in Broadhead, Wisconsin, about 100 miles west of Milwaukee. The production floor here is hot and humid and certainly stinky.
It smells like cheese.
Oh, yeah. You're going to smell a lot of cheese in here. Yeah.
Right now, there's a 35,000-pound stainless steel vat full of liquid Munster cheese in the process of changing to a solid. Munster is originally from France's Valley of Munster. It's one of those cheese products that could be in line for a name change, along with a lot of other cheese made here. Stettler says the problem with the EU's proposed restrictions is that U.S. food makers have spent a lot of money building their brands.
How do we educate our consumers? People have spent a great deal of money on labeling, building traditions, building a name on a product, and then not being able to use that name would be kind of horrific.
Shauna Morris is with the U.S. Dairy Export Council. She says since the EU started putting restrictions on food names in the mid-1990s, they've spread to other countries.
A couple years ago, the EU and Korea FTA banned the sale of U.S. feta, Asiago, Gorgonzola, and Fontina to Korea.
Morris says Costa Rica recently decided against allowing the sale of U.S. provolone and Parmesan, and South and Central America have similar restrictions. Morris argues it's less about civic pride and more about competition.
Actually, just last year, the U.S. became the largest single country exporter of cheese in the world.
And nearly a quarter of all cheese produced in the U.S. comes from Wisconsin. Even if eventually producers here can't use the same name, they'll always have this state's native product, cheese curds. For NPR News, I'm LaToya Dennis in Milwaukee.
Let's head now to one of the driest places in the country. It's a ribbon of 3 counties in the high desert of northern Nevada. This year's severe drought in the West has seen that part of the state declared a federal disaster area. It's one of the most important alfalfa-growing regions in the entire country and also home to a dairy industry that hopes to keep expanding despite this year's extreme hardship. Here's NPR's Kirk Ziegler.
When Pete Olson talks about drought on his 5th-generation dairy farm in Fallon, Nevada, he's really talking about the snowpack 60 miles to the west in the Sierra Nevada.
Yeah, the Sierras are our lifeblood.
That is, the snow melt from them that feeds the Truckee River and a tangle of reservoirs and canals that make this desert bloom. Some of the highest-grade alfalfa in the world is grown here. It makes perfect feed for dairy cows because it's rich in nutrients.
We milk 2,000 cows.
With the snowpack at historically low levels, feed will be in short supply. This is a big deal because the alfalfa that's grown here doesn't just stay local. There's demand for it in California, Asia, and beyond.
Depending on how bad it is, it could be daunting to try and find all the feed that we need.
Olson watches 60 of his milk cows lumber up onto a metal platform in a barn. Workers back them up and hook them onto milking machines. Nevada's dairy industry, like most of the state, was hit hard in the recession.
And we're starting to see a little light at the end of the tunnel, and now we get this drought.
And there's another problem. This drought has come just as dairies like Olson's are under pressure to expand, even double the size of their herds. A massive new powdered milk processing plant is scheduled to open.
We're just doing the finishing touches to get the plant up and running here in the next month.
This is Wesley Clark, manager of the $50 million plant. All of the powdered milk processed here will head to China, where demand is huge. Right now, local dairies can churn out about 800,000 pounds of milk a day. But once this plant's online, 1.2 million more pounds per day will be needed. That means thousands more cows and a lot more alfalfa, which takes a lot of water to grow. So does the drought threaten the dairy industry's expansion here? You bet.
We've got customers secured. Our customers, they need it now. They need it before we even start.
Local and state officials aggressively courted the plant here with tax incentives. The promotional literature touted Nevada as a great place to relocate a dairy to, or expand one. There's that ideal climate for growing alfalfa hay. There's ample water, they said. But this latest drought and predictions of more like it to come is raising questions about the long-term viability of farming in the arid West.
It's hard to believe that we can add a lot more agriculture in Nevada.
Kelly Redmond studies farming and climate in the Great Basin as a climatologist at the Desert Research Institute. It's a federally backed lab in Reno. Redmond says farmers in Nevada are increasingly competing for water with thirsty desert cities like Las Vegas.
That's where the money and the power is, and ag has sort of given way to this, you know, bit by bit.
Nevada was the driest state in the nation even before this historic drought. And the only reason farming is even possible here is that a century ago, the Bureau of Reclamation built the first ever federally funded dam and diversion project. It allowed water to plunge off the Sierra Nevada and down into farms in Fallon and beyond.
The way ag adjusts is to try to become more efficient, have more efficient types of crops, and just make better use of what water there is available for them.
For now, the dairy industry here is just focused on the short term. The plant's managers say they've started lining up contracts to bring in milk from outside this drought-stricken region, even though they'd rather not. It's more expensive, and the quality isn't as good. As for dairy farmer Pete Olson, he says this spring he'll likely grow less water-intensive alternatives to alfalfa, like the grain Milo.
It's not something we've had a lot of experience with. We haven't had to use it, but if we had multiple years like this year we're considering it.
Olson doesn't know how much, if any, irrigation water he'll get come spring. He is still planning to expand to meet the demands of the new plant, but he'll do it cautiously.
My dad told me a long time ago Nevada is a land of extremes, and it's been borne out in my experience that he's been right. We'll be really dry this year, and next year we'll get one of these gully washer winters that you'd wish it stopped snowing.
Olson says he and other farmers are also looking to the west, the towering Sierra, and praying those gully washers will come yet this winter. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
Good morning, I'm David Green. The YMCA in Quincy, Massachusetts has a new food offering. Honeydew Donuts has been cleared to open one of their stores there. Just one restriction, no donuts. Because the Y is focused on health and fitness, a spokeswoman says the donut shop's signature item is banned. Salads, fruit cups, smoothies are all allowed. So are Honeydew's low-fat muffins, which actually have more sugar and calories than the donuts. So take that to the treadmill. You're listening to Morning Edition.
Travel to another country and you may be surprised to learn that more and more you can find your favorite food no matter where you are. There's pizza in China and sushi in Scotland. And just as the menu looks very much the same across the globe, a new study shows that the world's farmers are growing an increasingly similar basket of crops. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
There's a slightly scary fact about our global food system. We humans depend on just a handful of crops for a lot of the food we eat. It's scary because any one of those crops could be hit by some disaster, like disease.
And we wanted to know really how many crops feed the world and what's happening with them.
That's Colin Curry, a researcher at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture in Cali, Colombia. Curry and some other scientists in Europe and the U.S. went through 50 years of data collected by the U.N.'s Food and Agriculture Organization. They published their findings this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Curry says the numbers revealed two big trends. Here's the first.
Hey, actually, there's places where diets are diversifying, where they're adding crops.
Think of countries in Asia like China, where people traditionally ate lots of rice. These days, in those countries, rice is a declining portion of the average person's diet. In the U.S., meanwhile, people are eating more mangoes. All over the world, in fact, people are eating a bigger variety of foods. But here's the second discovery. Those bigger menus of food also are getting more and more similar to each other, from Nanjing to Nairobi. Everybody is relying more and more heavily on a few dozen global megafoods. Many of those foods are part of what you'd call a standard Western diet, Curry says. Wheat, potatoes, dairy. But others come from the tropics, like palm oil.
It's grown in large scale in Malaysia, Indonesia, and it's become a global commodity in diets essentially everywhere.
Smaller crops are getting pushed aside. Sorghum and millet, for instance, are grown quite widely around the world, but they're losing out to corn and soybeans. Other small crops that you only find in certain areas could disappear altogether.
Like in the Andes, aside from potato, most of the rest of the traditional roots and tubers, crops like oca or maca, are declining in the amount of production, the amount of consumption.
Colin Curry says a lot of things are driving this trend. International trade, global restaurant chains.
People moving to the cities, having more access to supermarkets, to fast food, having less time to cook and not having gardens.
Curry says the bottom line is what people feared is true. We are more and more dependent on just a few dozen big crops. That trend probably can't be stopped, he says. But governments and international organizations can help to safeguard diversity in our food sources. They can preserve the many different genetic varieties of mega crops and promote minor crops. Rachel Loudon, a historian at the University of Texas and author of the book Cuisine and Empire, says what drives the rise and fall of crops, though, is demand for them after they've been transformed into something mouthwatering.
They're only interesting once they've been processed in some way.
Think of all the things people do with wheat.
You can get bread, flatbread, you can get porridge, you can get cake, pie, you can get beer.
That's what turned wheat into a mega crop. Roots and tubers, by contrast, were hard to store or transport or process into interesting foods. We can turn some of these minor crops into attractive food, she says, if there's enough interest. And there now may be. Consumers in the U.S. and Europe are snapping up little-known tropical fruits and so-called ancient grains. Maybe some of those minor crops can now find their spot on the global menu. Dan Charles, NPR News.